Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Yas here, and I'm calling today with a little favour to ask. Over the recent weeks and months, I've had loads of you get in touch with some great questions, and today I'm going to be trying something new with the show. I'm trialling a Q&A segment where I'll be joined by a co-host and elite coach educator, Gerard Jones. Now, these are discussions which are going to be taking place every Sunday evening at 7:30 GMT, live on Twitter Space, if you wanted to get involved directly. Otherwise, I'll be releasing them here every Wednesday on the Coaches Network podcast. So for today's format, slightly different, and for around about 30 minutes, each discussion will be dedicated to a question that has been sent in, where myself and Gerard will be going into some real depth and sharing our views and opinions on the topic in order to leave you with some key takeaways to consider in your own environments. So the favour I'm asking for today, guys, is if you could let me know your thoughts on the new format, and you can do this by getting in touch on Twitter at TheCoachesNet. Once again, that is at TheCoachesNet. And of course, if you have a question, feel free to send that in too. Hope you enjoy the new format.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Craig Johns. Morning, Craig. Afternoon, evening, depending on where you are in the world. How are you, Craig?
I'm very well, thanks, Yas. It's good to see your smiling face.
Awesome. Craig, just before we get into the real thick of the conversation, maybe a brief insight around who you are, what you do, and then we'll dive in straight from there.
Yeah, thanks. So, right now, I'm a high-performance leadership expert and also the CEO and managing partner of Speakers Institute Corporate. I grew up in New Zealand on a small farm with the nearest neighbour a mile away. So when COVID hit, I went into my happy place, so to speak. It was like, this feels like growing up when I was a kid. For me, I've always had that mindset of, a very positive mindset, I would say, and always looking at, what is it that I can achieve? I always had that mindset of this is what I want to do and how am I going to get there? And I kind of felt frustrated when I was little watching other people who just seemed lost in the world. They didn't know what to do, what they were supposed to be doing in the world. And for me, I had real clarity as a youngster that one, I wanted to be an athlete. I knew following that I would be a coach, and I also wanted to be a CEO of a big company globally at some point. So My direction was always very, very clear from there. So I managed to win 10 national titles across 4 individual sports of triathlon, duathlon, cycling and mountain biking, and then also represented New Zealand as in field hockey as a junior. Never got to play, just made the squad and then had to make that choice between the individual or team sports. Did quite a bit of work in sports science, through especially in New Zealand around some of the Olympic sports and professional sports. And along the way, I've always coached. So from a very, very young age, my first coaching stint would have been 12 years old, where I was given the reins to look after a provincial team for a session. And that was kind of really empowering at that age to have that opportunity. And then from the age of 15, was into paid coaching for swimming, triathlon, surf lifesaving and field hockey over a number of years, including being a national head coach for triathlon in Asia. I transitioned after a few years into the world of corporate and really wanted to push myself in that realm. I loved high performance, but I wanted to have a bigger impact on the world. And as much as I loved that high performance and ability to work with individuals, for me, there was just something missing. And so I loved the aspect of moving into C-suite and being a CEO, and now in a position where we train a lot of leaders from emerging right through to global leaders in some of the biggest companies around the world. So, that's kind of a bit of a snapshot of my life.
That's awesome. Obviously, you know, within that snapshot, you've kind of linked into a range of depth and wealth of experiences, both in the corporate world and obviously in sports in particular. There's a couple of key things that kind of really just jumped out at me. So I'm going to start with this one. You said coaching right along, whole way through. First stint at 12. And you also talked about how it was empowering. But I just want to talk a little bit more about that. How important do you think it is for young athletes, for young people in general, to get the opportunity to demonstrate leadership or be in a leadership, you know, capacity at such a young age?
One, you've got that ability to see it from a different perspective. I think when you're an athlete, you become very single-minded at times. When you're a coach, you've then got to look at it from different perspectives. How do you motivate someone else? How do you see it through a lens of another athlete or group of athletes? And so I found that really good. But when I talked about empowering, you know, when you have someone that looks at you, you know, you're only 12 years old and goes, right, I see you've got talent and I'm going to empower you to run a session. So literally they said, you've got a whole entire session. What do you want to do? And, you know, obviously they gave me a couple of parameters around, you know, they're heading into a tournament coming up. You know, what are you seeing? What do you feel? And so they really gave me the reins. And I thought that was quite fascinating that, you know, people who are really effective coaches and had coached really, really well in their careers were just giving this opportunity to someone really, really young and just saying, hey, you know what? We trust you. We back you. Yes, we're going to be here watching just in case, but we back you. And I think that's important.
But just on that, obviously, cause, you know, that's a big piece. You know, there's going to be a lot of coaches thinking it's great that the coach has trusted you, but how do we get to a point where we can trust our athletes? How do, you know, what does it take for the athlete to demonstrate, or what does it take for us as coaches to get to the point where we can actually hand over those reins?
Yeah, I think there's always a period when you're dealing with athletes where you've got to train them first, right? There's that training, teaching mode where you are pretty much sharing lots and you get them to do something. Before you start moving more into that coaching space where you're asking them questions, you're getting them to figure things out for themselves. I think when you're at that point, and you can sense that someone has a level of responsibility, they have a sense of a bit of a service mindset that they want to help other people, then I think we should trust them. I think we should give them. A lot of the time as coaches, we tend to think that we're the ones who need to know more than the athletes. We're the ones who need to show them what to do. But the athletes are the ones on the field. Yeah, they're the ones on the road or in the pool or in the gym. And they can feel things as well. They see things. And a lot of the time we don't give them enough credit to actually ask them, what do you think? How could we do this better? And they have the answers a lot of the time. But we kind of feel that, oh, we're in this position where we should know more. So I think it's too risky to hand over the reins sometimes. And so obviously you need to set some boundaries, but you need to give them some flexibility to go, you know what, here's an opportunity to see it through. To give them a chance to try and help other people to maybe even enhance themselves. Mm. And in the long run, it's going to, you know, give that person, you know, especially, you know, sometimes the more talented kids can sometimes get, their ego gets a bit too high. And so they become a bit self-centered. So this gives them a chance to think outside of themselves and a little bit more holistic at other people and what their roles may be and how they work as well.
Let's talk about that. You know, you said it was quite empowering for you. How did that then, you know, transform itself, you know, or transcend itself into your, you know, your playing career or your, you know, your journey as an athlete in the following years, often at 12 years old to get that experience? Did it shift the way that you maybe applied yourself in training? Did it make you think differently about what you wanted to go and start doing at that point? And how, you know, you said earlier on that your direction was quite clear. Obviously, we never knew what was going to end up happening off it, but I think you were very clear in what you wanted to achieve as a, on the grand scheme of things. So how did that impact you going forward?
Look, I don't think it was that one instance. On my dad's side, they were all into field hockey. So my granddad and my dad both coached provincial teams. And, you know, I think dad had the potential to go on and coach a national team, but he didn't have any education. And he kind of, I think maybe that was a bit of a limiting belief for him that he needed that education to be able to progress. And he also had the farm, so he didn't really have the time to put into that. Mum's side were all into cricket. So both my granddad and my uncle were very, very good at cricket, both captains, both coaches of provincial teams. And so there was that grounding there already, and very much from my both mum and dad, very much service-minded. My mum was a nurse and plus involved in the community. Dad was always on the board of trustees. He was always, you know, on the committees of sports teams. And so they were always involved in kind of helping the community in a way. So I kind of grew up in a space where it was a lot about giving first and receiving second, which I think keeps your feet grounded as an athlete too along the way. And so every time you kind of get into a space where you might be getting a bit too focused on yourself, I think, you know, when you're in a position of coaching, it kind of brings you back down a little bit and keeps you a bit more, not so much balanced, but a little bit more aware that there's more than just you in this world, and there's more than just what you're trying to achieve. There are other people that need to be involved as well.
I think it's a great point in the fact that essentially it helps you to build your empathy, right? I'm just now thinking wider from your own journey, then, you know, how much of a part does this play into your journey and some of the successes that you've had? Because, you know, we spoke very briefly off air in that, you know, often people assume that high performing behaviors are maybe exclusive for high performing environments, but obviously these behaviors have to be learned somewhere. They have to be I don't think people are just born with them. I think there's probably things like that you've touched on there about, you know, the influences around us, the environment that we've grown up in that expose us to some of these things. So, you know, what are some of the things that you'd maybe think, you know, did influence that early on and it really started to set the scene for you around actually these are key pivotal moments for me as in terms of what you went on to achieve and I guess the grit and determination within it that it took to, you know, to perform at that level that you did end up getting to?
The whole nature and nurture discussion that happens, you know, for me, leaders or athletes can all be developed along the way. Coaches can be developed. But those that become world class, I think there is definitely some nature involved, and also something else. When you look at those superstar athletes or the superstar coaches, 99% of the time, there's something inside their belly that fuels them. They, you know, you look at Lance Armstrong, for instance, right? So he grew up single mom. He hated the world. He was trying to beat the world because of what had happened. And then obviously then he gets dealt the big blow of cancer. And, you know, a lot of people focus on the drugs, so to speak. But when you look at where he had a death sentence and the amount of cancers and the size of the cancers throughout his body, he really shouldn't have lived. And so for him, it was just an opportunity that I'm not taking no for an answer, and I'm going to do whatever it takes. And, you know, sometimes he may have pushed the boundaries there, and we all know that, right? He pushed the boundaries too far. There maybe wasn't a clear enough boundary for him in the environment that was around him. But if we look at, you know, all these people, there is something that really fuels them as well. So when we talk about high performance, I think there's a lot of misconceptions in the world where, you know, people talk about all these high performing habits, all these high performing things. Yes, they are. But to me, they're just performance things. The high performance is another level. And it's that ability to take those baseline fundamentals to another level. And it needs to be fueled with some sense, I suppose, of a very narrowed vision, which can be a detriment at times. We all know this, but it needs to be very narrowed so that you're removing all the distractions, so you are 100% focused on what you're trying to achieve. Now, in some environments, that may not be possible. You know, if you want to have a healthy relationship in your family, if you want to have a healthy social life, etc., you sometimes cannot do that in the environment you're in. So environments do come into play as well. But in most cases, anyone can develop, I believe, anyone can develop the fundamentals of what leads to high performance, which is living a high level of performance at any one time. And it doesn't matter what you do in the world, whether you're an athlete, you're a mum, you're a fireman, you're a CEO, you're a coach, those fundamentals don't change at all.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. I think, you know, spot on in that, in our conversations I'm often having with people and coaches in particular, that just because they're not, you know, you're not in a high performing environment specifically, doesn't mean that you can't exhibit high performing behaviors. But that, you know, I think there's something really key in what you said to start off with, in that, again, another belief I have. I say to parents all the time, especially when I'm working with players and even trying to support coaches, is that they can have the best training programs, they can have the best facilities, they can have the best everything. But fundamentally, the one thing that a coach probably cannot coach, in my opinion, is their belief and their innate desire to want something. They have to want it. We can't coach them to want it. They have to want it. It has to be innate within them. And I do believe that quite firmly, that, like I said, I can give you, Craig, the best facilities, the best coaching, I can bring the best team of people in to work with you. But if you don't want it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can't have someone else wanting it for you. You know, we see a lot of parents who want it for their kids, and, you know, the kids may not always want it. And so our job as coaches is to try and find what is going to fuel the fire in their belly. What does, you know, get them up so they are focused every time, they're disciplined, they're pushing, they're willing to take risks, they have that ability to go into that uncomfortable zone multiple times, they have the discipline to know when to stop and take a rest and actually apply the things that are required to be a high performing athlete or high performing person in this world. And, you know, when you talk about that real belief and desire, when it comes to high performance athletes, as a coach, you're not motivating them. All right, you're not in motivation mode. They have enough motivation. In most cases, you're actually trying to pull back the motivation because they're sometimes pushing too hard. They're so driven that they may miss the importance of recovery. They may miss the importance of focusing on the basics, and they drive too hard. So you sometimes got to temper that motivation. If you're a coach who's motivating, then you're in a dangerous position. Why? Because the athletes need to keep coming back to you. Their reason for living, breathing, doing something is directly related to you as the coach, if you're in motivational mode. I like to think of coaches should be in an inspiration mode. You need to inspire people to draw out their own internal motivation. Right, you don't motivate them. You inspire them to draw out their own motivation. So you need to find out what is going to fuel each person individually, because they're all different. What fuels their fire so that they feel motivated to really drive forward for something on their own or collectively, if it's part of a team, to do incredible things in this world. And when it comes to belief, a lot of the time, as I mentioned before, they're either pushing too hard, they're so highly motivated, or they're held back by limiting beliefs and things that something has happened in the past, and they have then formed their own meaning in their head, and now they've created a new belief which actually prevents them from being who they are. So we've got to be able to pull the reins back sometimes, but plus we need to unlock the chain, so to speak, to let people free. I think they're two of the biggest roles that we have as coaches.
It's quite interesting because, obviously, you know, you talked there about inspire versus motivate. And I think I fully get what you mean. There'll be a lot of coaches out there thinking, though, it's their job to motivate. And I think there is occasions where that might need to happen. It might need to be, but I think more from a perspective of reassurance, right? And encouragement, as opposed to a constant source where the players are fundamentally reliant on you. I do think, for me, the coaches' role should be one where they aim to almost make themselves redundant, so that the coach isn't needed by the players, but the coach is maybe wanted by the players or the athletes, because of the impact that they've been able to have, because of the, you know, because of the development they've been able to achieve under the guidance or supervision of that individual, and even just the environment that's been set around them, the joy and the, you know, pleasure and the successes they've achieved within that. So let's talk about that. And obviously you've gone on and you mentioned that obviously you had to make a decision between team sports and individual sports. You've had quite a lot of successes in the individual capacity. what shifted you one way or the other at that first stage?
Yeah, so maybe I'll go back to some younger years and a couple of things that happened. So I had an interesting first week of school. My first week of school, I won the cross country. I fainted and I got hit above the eye and required stitches by a baseball bat. So I had a real adventurous first week of school, I'm very courageous, right? I want to get part of the action. You know, I wanted to win. I think that was always there. But there was also something there we didn't pick up, which was something to do with my heart. And between the ages of 5 and 12, I would faint 3 or 4 times a year, which is out of the ordinary. Like most kids might faint 3 or 4 times in their entire primary school. I was doing it 3 or 4 times a year. They could never work out what was happening, and I was never really in too much danger. So, you know, and at the age of 12, it stopped. So we didn't worry about it then. It never affected my sporting up until that point. I don't think, if I remember correctly, I don't think it affected me then. And then when I was 16, I come off the biggest swim camp I'd ever done. I was absolutely flying to a point where people were stopping and going, what's just happened to you? You know, like I just went to a whole nother level where I felt extremely free. I was in flow in a session, and then woke up the next morning, which was New Year's Day, 2016, at 6 o'clock in the morning, went to go to the bathroom, blacked out, and was unconscious for over 5 minutes. My dad at that point had just had a hip replacement. My mum and sister were at the cow shed. Dad was trying to ring mum, and they thought, oh, look, Craig and dad are at home, they'll be okay. So they didn't bother. Dad's on crutches. He's looking at me going, he's like, mate, this guy's dead. Like literally looking at me as I was dead and wasn't moving. Was, you know, his eyes were sunking in. He managed to, you know, hit me a few times with the crutch. I think he describes it. And I sort of came to, but I couldn't move for the next 30 minutes. You know, here I am, like the fittest I'd ever been in my life. He manages to get over, get mum, my sister. I'm still lying on the floor. They come back and they managed to get me up. I was like dead weight. I got to the bed, which is in the lounge where dad had made a bed so he could watch TV while he had his hip replacement. And then I kind of went to sleep. I got up about 2 hours later. Everyone was at the breakfast table and I said, hey, I'm going to go for a 40K bike ride today. And just before I got to the table, I said, I'm going to go. And I fainted and I went straight into the bookshelf and I went out for another 2.5 minutes. So obviously at this point, the ambulance came in, I rushed off to hospital, got the defib paddles there, all the cardiologists around trying to figure out what's going on. But I was going into atrial fibrillation. So for those who understand, it's a regular heartbeat, usually associated with older people and those maybe who have had heart attacks. This is pretty rare in younger people. I had vasovagal syncope, and my heart rate at that point was 32. And at night, and actually it still is, actually it hasn't dropped. It hasn't gone up, I should say. My resting heart was 32. At night, would drop to 24. And they couldn't figure out, like, really why I had it. And so they monitored me and I stayed in it for a couple of weeks in intensive care and then able to go home. And at that point they said, you need to give up sport. And me being very analytical and strategic was going, okay, at the moment you have zero proof. You've asked all the best sport cardiologists in the world. No one's giving proof that for me going back to sport is going to endanger my life. And so within 3 or 4 weeks I went back to sport, and within 12 months I had made New Zealand team, New Zealand squad in field hockey and New Zealand team for triathlon in 1 year. And so it certainly didn't hold me back. I did need to be a bit more cautious. But I think from that day, I woke up every day and I was like, thank God I'm alive. You know, I think it was a really different perspective to a lot of athletes. You know, for me, it was thank God I'm alive. So I took away a lot of pressure from myself in a way, and I could just race free, I could, etc. And there were a lot more talented people out there than me. And it was more that I was able to maximize my talent, knowing that today could be the last day. And that was how I thought of it, and still do today. You know, for me, it's like, yeah, hey, I'm still alive. I went on to World Champs a couple of years later in triathlon. At that point, it was just too much to do a team sport and individual sport at a really high level. And then I got to 2021, and I started fainting 3 or 4 times a day for an entire month. And so at that point, I couldn't drive. I couldn't finish my last university papers, and they gave me just a grade. And I was a bit disappointed because I went from A plus 100% in human anatomy to an A minus, and I was the only person that actually got 100% in the exam. And I was like, how do I go to an A minus just because I didn't sit the final exam because of medical things? But anyway, another story. And one day I was swim teaching. I was holding 2 18-month-old kids. I could feel myself start to faint. I had to roll out of the water, put the kids down, and then lay on the side of the pool. And at that point, I gave up. I had to stop everything until they could figure out what was going on. Got put in hospital for suspected heart attacks because someone misread the ECG. I've got in the red zone, I've got people dying around me being revived. And I'm like, what am I doing here? I feel absolutely fine. And at that point, they said, look, there's only one thing we can do. We've looked at everything. The only thing we can do is to put a pacemaker in, and hopefully that will stop you blacking out. Because we cannot solve this. There's some electrical fault happening here. For whatever reason, your heart rate will go from whatever you're doing to below 40 and just hold there. And so, as you can imagine, if you're running or, you know, you're doing something and it drops that fast, all you want to do is faint. You know, your body needs oxygen in the brain. And so I gave up sport at that time and really focused on coaching, on the sports science, and really dedicated myself to that. You know, put on quite a bit of weight, and then moved. I had an opportunity to move to Asia. And the day I got there, my mate said, we're going to buy a bike. So it was kind of a space where they gave you a whole lot of money in a brown paper bag and said, go set up your house. And my mate goes, nah, you don't need all that money. Just spend some of it on a bike. You're going to get fit again. And so I lost 17 kgs in the first year and went on to do Ironman Austria. And then, you know, from then on, that's when I won my national titles. I had not won any until that point. And so I won 10 over the next few years. But I think it really comes down to that release of, if I, you know, I'm just lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to wake up. I was coaching all through that time as well. So I wasn't having to worry about a living. So I took all the pressure off being an athlete, and I could just do it for absolute fun. And I still wanted to win and was still as driven as everyone else, but I didn't have anything holding me back from achieving. And so, you know, in some ways I'm very grateful for having a heart that we still don't know, what's wrong with it, and still has caused me to flatline a couple of times since, but you know, I'm still alive. So for me, I'm grateful in that sense that it has given me that opportunity. And I think if I transfer that across to leading or coaching, now I'm present. Why? I'm absolutely present that moment because I don't know if I'm going to wake up the next day. And that's how I approach my life.
I think it's fascinating because obviously, you know, in a roundabout way, one thing I've taken away from what you've just said is that you inadvertently found your why, right? You know, you found your why in many respects, because it's almost like, well, I don't know if I'm going to get this opportunity again, so I'm going to have to give it my all almost. Obviously, that's not necessarily the same, and you know, for everyone. But fundamentally, that's come from within you because you've had to have a different appreciation for the situation you're in, rather than, you know, like I said, if you take your situation for granted, you might not apply yourself to the best of your ability. And I think this is really key, because I think something you touched on earlier, right, is around, you've got those people who are highly talented, and some people are more talented than others in many respects. But actually, you know, and it's a conversation that, you know, again, I'm often having with coaches and athletes around the idea of leisure individuals versus high performing individuals, or performance individuals in particular, in the fact that you don't have to be, or rather, just because you're working, you know, just because you're operating in a high performing environment, you know, you hear about athletes all the time, especially, you know, in football, soccer, where actually they just happen to be really talented, but they could not give anything about the game of football or soccer. They just happen to be highly mm-hmm. talented, and they recognize that actually I'm just here to do a job for other people. It's more than that. And obviously that extends itself the other way as well, because you could have high performing individuals demonstrating, you know, high performing habits and behaviors in environments which aren't necessarily considered high performing, and they're just recreational and performing, you know, leisure environments, if you like. And I think you've kind of, in many respects, alluded to that, in the sense that, you know, you're going to have those highly talented people, but unless they do perform and exhibit these behaviors, they're not going to do anything with it. So I guess on that then, from a coaching perspective, in your experiences then, how do you go about helping athletes, or just individuals generally, even in the work that you do, become more aware of those subtle differences?
Good question. I just want to touch on something quickly, because you talked about finding a purpose. It wasn't so much about finding my purpose. I think it amplified it. I always had the question, golly, definitely was there at the beginning of high school, maybe even earlier, around why aren't people healthier, happier, and hungrier for success? And so I think those three things together, because it was my view, I saw a lot of talented people that were unhealthy or weren't happy. Or I saw really healthy people that seemed to be happy but weren't hungry for anything. And I'm like, why are you wasting all your talent? So that question of those three things, and I think that mindset of that helps me now when I look at individuals and go, okay, cool. Yeah, you've got talent, but are you healthy, happy, and hungry for success? And if you're not, how do I work on one, two, or even three of those things? And you know, really tying into that question there around the, you know, what does it mean to be high performing in a way? It doesn't mean, you know, just because you got talent doesn't mean you're a great athlete or a great human being. I think it's that importance of, and we hear this more often now, you know, developing the human as well as the athlete and going beyond that. And so with coaching people, I think you first got to really grasp, why are they there? Like what motivates them? And then do you need to go into inspiration mode to draw more of that out? Do you need, is there something holding them back that is preventing them from being that athlete? So what is it? Is it a mindset thing we need to deal with? When we look at, kind of jumping a tangent here, but when we look at high-performing people and high-performing teams, high-performing athletes, I mean the real true high-performing ones, they always have a really clear positive vision, right? This is, you know, say it's a football player in the UK, you know, maybe it's to win the Premiership League, right? Their vision, their clarity of vision is to stand at the end of the year with the EPL trophy, you know, holding the big trophy up. That is their big dream, or the Champions Trophy, whatever it may be. That is their dream from a positive, but they always have a negative vision as well. And the negative vision is not the vision they want to achieve. It is the bare minimum standard they will drop to, or allow themselves to drop to. They won't allow themselves to drop below that. So they have these two visions. Everyone thinks it's all positive. It's not. They have really high significance or self-worth. Right? They've got, some people may consider it as really high ego. And remember, ego is healthy until it gets to a space where you use it to a negative point of view or you overdo it. But they have high ego, but they also have extremely high level of uncertainty in them as well. They have both, right? So, and it's fascinating. A lot of people go, oh, we need to remove their limiting beliefs. Well, first, you can't remove a limiting belief. You can only manage it. But sometimes, should we actually manage that limiting belief? How far should we manage it? Because you still want them fueling it. Because that makes sure that they don't drop below that minimum level.
Yeah.
It draws the fire in their belly a bit.
But I think just on that, you know, something you just touched on there, that it's made me think, you can't remove the limiting beliefs. You can only manage it. And, you know, slightly off topic, but a conversation I've been having with coaches recently is around identifying potential, right? And in identifying potential, you know, the question I often kind of pose towards coaches is that, are we, I mean, how do we know where we're effectively identifying potential? Because fundamentally, if we're looking at it through our eyes, there's things that we might not be able to see, right? So I'll be limiting them based on what we believe is achievable through our lens. So, you know, come back to what you said there, you know, you talk about limiting beliefs. Well, is it only a limiting belief for us because we haven't experienced, or our experiences show us that maybe that's something we would deal with, if that makes sense?
Yeah, 100%. I think so too. I mean, it's just made me think as well, what is, what is potential and what is talent, especially when you look at a team sport. I'm going to say team here because individual is a bit different. Like, if you're a triathlete, you have to be, you can't hide. I'm sorry. You literally can't hide. You could be a bit stronger at one discipline than the other two, or you could be stronger at two than the third one. Very rarely is anyone really strong at all three. And if you are, then you've got a greater chance of you've been able to dominate more often. But in a team sport, what is potential? Because you need the leaders, you need those that are the glue in the team, you need those that are complementary skill sets to others. So you can't have a one size fits all as a coach. You know, and when we look at talent, what is it? You know, it can't be just a one, like, as I said, a one size fits all for your entire team. It cannot be. It cannot be. I was fortunate enough to be part of a New Zealand record 272 unbeaten streak with field hockey. New Zealand record by a long shot. Globally, I don't know of any other teams that have gone above that I'm aware of. So to give you context, that's 16 years without losing a game. They lost one game before that, and they had actually won, it's either 4 or 5 years leading into that. So they lost one game in 21 years. And for me, I was able to be in that team for the first 5 years of that winning streak. So I never lost a game. And, you know, it's really interesting when you start looking at that team. Yes, there was one key person in a way, but there were five leaders in there, but you would only know and there was one leader. Anyone looking from the outside would only see one. Those internally could feel the five leaders in that team leading at different roles, and everyone knew what it was. It didn't need to be said. They just did their thing, and everyone knew when to follow. Everyone in there knew, like, I think all great leaders know also how to be great followers, and they need to know when to be a follower. And anyone who thinks they are a leader or thinks they are a captain 100% of the time, or thinks they're the coach as the leader 100% of the time, you're not going to be that successful. You need to know when to follow. You need to know when it's your role to be a follower, your role to be a connector, etc. in that team. And so that is so crucial. And it was something that was so evident in that team. You know, a number of those people were extremely effective leaders in their own right, some in provincial teams, some as bank managers. For me, I was a head boy, but also captains of many teams. But in that team, I knew my role. And it wasn't leading. I just did my role. That was it. I followed, I connected, I did what I needed to do to make sure that team was highly successful. And so when we look at building high-performing teams and the talent that's involved, there do needs to be some non-negotiables. You need to determine what they are. You need to determine what they are. And you're not just looking for the most gifted, you know, if it's field hockey, 11 players, soccer's the same, right? 11 players on the field or rugby, 15. You can't just look for the 15 most gifted people. It's not going to work. We saw it with the USA basketball team. So how do we shape that team and bring the right people in to make sure that it works as an ecosystem, not an ecosystem?
I think it's a great point. You know, you talked there about the USA basketball team. I think we saw it many years ago with the England football team as well, where they probably had what they would consider their golden generation as a collective group of players. But didn't really achieve anything. I think it was partly that. It was that they didn't have the right individuals to develop a team. They just had many talented individuals. And sometimes, you know, we hear that it might be the player that's least talented. Actually, they're the glue that keeps everyone together. And you hear about this all the time. So I think, you know, it's really important to kind of highlight that. But then, in many respects, you know, people will look at that one individual that is the glue for the team and say, well, that young person's not really a high performer, though. So, how do you get coaches to maybe widen their horizons on that?
To widen away from one high performer?
Yeah, well, more specifically looking at, right, well, how do we get that? You know, how do we get coaches to think, okay, well, this person might not be as talented as the others, but actually they are. That they don't need to be that talented because actually that's not their role in the team, if you like.
Yeah, look, if you've got a superstar in your team, you need to figure out how to unleash them so they can do their magic, right? You have to create a team that allows that person to create the magic, but also you need that team to be able to also create magic without that player. If that player's injured or that player leaves, how do you still create the magic without that person on the field or on the court or whatever it may be? And so I think it's important and this doesn't always happen. So I talked about they're creating an ecosystem, not an ego system. So let's look at what they are. An ego system is where everyone has really high self-worth and they're focused on themselves. An ecosystem is a weak system first. So you've got ecosystem, weak system. A weak system is where you get everyone to focus on the collective worth. The ecosystem is where you get you're focusing on developing both the self-worth and the collective worth. Because people need to feel importance, people need to feel significance. So you've got to still focus on that self-worth and the individual. And you need to boost them at the right times. You need to challenge them at the right times. But you need to make sure that their belief and their confidence comes up in themselves while also lifting the collective worth. How do we know what our role in the team is? What is that higher purpose that we're all driving forward to? Why do we turn up every single week and to make sure we've got each other's back? And so the importance of self-worth and collective worth is so important. So ego is not the problem. Ego is not the problem. It's how we manage the ego with the collective of the entire group. That's the key when it comes to developing a team, whether you've got an outstanding individual or you've got a group of highly talented people. Now, to be honest, it's really difficult when you've got a lot of talented people because you've got to know when to pull them back and how to still keep them motivated and driven when you may put them into a role which is more of a connector or a follower situation. And that takes work. That's hard work as a coach. But yeah, that's your 100%. Role. You've got to figure out how to do it.
I think, you know, part of that is obviously looking at, like you said, the ego piece, right? Because if someone's used to it, and I think this is the other piece, so when I say to coach sometimes, like, you're going to get times where players or athletes have come into you from other environments where they've been the star. They've got talent, but they've been the star. And sometimes because they've been the star in certain environments, and sometimes in many cases been the star in environments where there isn't really any other stars, they have developed an ego, but they've also never been held accountable. So, you know, let's talk about that a little bit. How important you think accountability is in terms of developing athletes and helping them understand their position, their place within the environment, if you like.
I think it's important for coaches as well to create an environment where it's not a right to be on the team. It's a responsibility. And it doesn't matter how good you are. You still have to... you've still got to prove your worth to belong in that team. So it's got nothing to do with your absolute athletic potential and ability and what you've done previously. You have to prove that you're worthy of being on that team. And when I go back to that team that went unbeaten for 272 games, there are a lot of gifted people that never made it. they were on their own individual account were better than the players on the team. They never even got a start. Some of them may have made the bench because they hadn't taken the steps to understand that they need to fit and belong on the team. So it's a responsibility to be part of a team. And so as coaches, we have to make sure that's super clear, and we need to create an environment where all the people that are involved in it have already bought in and they hold each other accountable. So it's that permission for each person to hold each other accountable. And if the coach is having to hold a new athlete accountable, it's not really going to work. It needs to be the entire team. And so therefore you need to create that permission where they have courage. They can have those uncomfortable conversations. And by the way, for anyone out there who thinks that high-performing teams, everything's rosy, it's not. There's generally more conflict in those high-performing teams and challenges because of the diversity that it's required to create a great team. But their ability to separate the problem from the person and be able to deal with anything that is uncertain, they're unsure about, they're uncomfortable about, maybe they have a different perspective, deal with it quickly and openly and let go in a way that is separating the person from the problem. If you can do that, then you're going to start to create a high-performing team where people hold each other accountable too. So what are those really strong, what's the real strong DNA of the team? I don't really like values, by I prefer DNA. Why? Because values subconsciously will refer someone back to, well, I value this, I value that, which is based on their environment and what they've grown up in. When you come into a new environment, someone says, here are the values you got to live by, they're like, well, hang on, that doesn't quite connect with the values I've grown up with. So I like, what is the DNA? What is the acceptable behaviors and attitudes and mindset that each person's going to hold each other accountable for?
Yeah. I think in many respects, I'm just thinking about what you said, it's really, what's the protocol that we're going to follow, right?
Because yeah, manifest.
You know, because even in that conflict resolution piece that you talked about there around, there's going to be things that do happen in these environments. It's just they've probably got a clear process in what they're going to follow to kind of get over these problems. And they've almost preempted these things are going to happen. So they've got processes in place to manage them, right? So, you know, let's talk about that. Like, you know, obviously, you know, high-performing environments, you know, where or not, they are going to have these conflict issues. What are some effective ways that you think that would probably coaches can kind of start to implement within their structures that will allow athletes to better manage these things? Because I'm of the mind that I go back, you know, we go back full circle and go back to your story around, you know, when you first started getting involved in coaching and you had the coaches watching you coach. I'm probably very much like that when my players are dealing with conflict amongst one another. I probably just to stand back and watch and see, right, how do they manage this? You know, provided it doesn't become a matter of safety, then probably I'll leave them to resolve it, right? Because the one thing I think is also is that, you know, if you, in order to be better at dealing with conflict, you have to, well, in order to be good at conflict resolution, you need to be able to deal with conflict. You need to be thrown in the deep end so you can manage it, right?
Yes, in some ways, but in other ways, you can teach people certain things. And when I talked about separating the problem from the person, there's a couple of simple ways to do that. But before I get to that, to me, I think it's important that you create an environment of nurturing rising talent, what we call nurturing rising talent. So that means you create a space where people are open to share feedback. But it always must be, and if it's for a growth mindset perspective or growth feedback perspective, then don't use a feedback sandwich because it's fundamentally flawed. But start with I'll use the terms we use, so GEM, which is positive reinforcement. So don't just cheerlead and say, hey, that was awesome, you were great, because that's like a sugar hit. We don't know what that meant. So the positive reinforcement, what did they actually do well? And that being 20% of the conversation or the feedback part of it, only 20%. Don't make it too long, enough to realize that you care, that you've seen something they've done really well, but don't overemphasize it, because players will naturally gravitate, and this is why the feedback sandwich doesn't work, is because they'll gravitate to the really good things on the front and the end, and they'll miss the middle, unless the middle is like hitting them with a dagger and it's really personal. But then the opportunity, which is the 80%, needs to be delivered in a way. And there are two words and that people use commonly that make something a personal attack. The first word is you. You did this, you did that, you did this, etc. So it's you. It's like, whoa, hey, hang on. Or it's, why did you do that? So there are times to use why and use you, but not at the beginning of the sentences when you're giving an observation of ways to improve or that you didn't like something and you want to address something. So when we go into conflict situations or areas of we feel that people could improve, it needs to be from the sense where we're separating the problem from the person, where you go, you use sentences like, this is what I observed. I felt, have you considered what I noticed was? So it's an observation piece more than direct. So if you can start that early in the culture of your team and grow that through, when you do get hit with those conflict situations, they've got the tools and the skills to deal with it in a humane way that separates the problem from the person. They can deal with the problem without affecting the relationship. Because when it comes to conflict, when it comes to any sort of situation where it might get a bit challenging, people generally don't tend to share because they've got fear of the repercussions, or they don't want to hurt the relationship. You know, they want to maintain the relationship, which is so important in a team or a coach-athlete environment. So this way allows people to be able to do that in a way where when it comes to the big, tough calls, we're already ready for it. Like we are conditioned to that, being able to give really strong fear. And by the way, by doing this gem opportunity in the way of separating the person from the problem, you can hit them with some really hard feedback, really, really hard, but they will feel it coming from the right place. It'll come from the heart, yeah. And it doesn't feel like a dagger being put in their back or in their heart.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I'm quite interested that you say that, because I'm now thinking back to some of the interactions I've had with players, and often I do start with that piece. You know, it's just an observation. I've made, I try and engage them in that conversation by sharing the observation and then getting their insight on my observation. Do you agree? You know, does that resonate with you, or you know, do you feel like that's what happened? And just to get their perception on it, right? And then kind of tailing onto the back end of what you just said, there is always that. Even if they don't agree with your information, they don't like your information, and they don't see the true value in it in the way that you do, if they fundamentally believe it's coming from a good place, they will pay attention to it.
Mm.
And that's what my experience has taught me. So, you know, even when I've seen coaches that are speaking to certain athletes, and you can see the athlete in their minds, they're just not having this coach, because... Mm. The coach is, I think it's important as a coach to be passionate, right? And that passion has to kind of come across, but not passion in the topic itself, but passion in the want and need to try and help this individual. It's almost like that genuine care, right? And I think from my experience, athletes, they will pick up on that very quickly if you're not genuine. Mm. I think authenticity is key here. So I think for me, that piece is really important. Having their trust, I think, will trump whether you have the right level of experience, knowledge, and insight to actually add value. But just having the trust in the first place will be the key that opens the door to allow you to support them, if that makes sense.
Look, my experience of coaching and leading, 50% of my job is care. Is caring for the individual, ensuring that they feel like that you care about what they do and it matters. Care is everything when it comes to coaching or leading, everything. You know, and so how do you create that space where they can feel that genuine care? Now, a lot of the time, Let's use public speaking, for instance, right? It's something that I think, what do they say? I think there's a kind of an interesting quote out there that 90% of people at a funeral would rather be in the casket rather than delivering the eulogy. That's how much we fear speaking in public. The reason why people fear speaking in public is their intention they have. Okay, so the intention is, what am I going to say? Am I saying the right thing? What do people think? What if I say the wrong thing? What if I get proven wrong? So it's very self-centered. But if we can shift that intention to what is holding you back and how can I help, we are now in a, we now remove the passion will then come from your bones. It will be embodied, but it's not an attacking passion. The people will feel that passion because your intention is in the right space. It is in a service space, not in a I'm the best space or I need to be significant space in this moment. And so as any time that a coach feels like their passion is becoming too much, just check, where is your intention right now? And for me, like, it doesn't matter if I'm having this conversation with you right now and our listeners, my intention naturally is, what is holding you back as the listeners to this, and most of you are coaches, and how can I help? Like, for me, it's not saying this is how you do it or go suck eggs because I'm going to tell you what you already know. It is like, no, this to me is things that I've learned along the way that I feel can help people be more effective in developing a culture or leading teams. And so it's really important to understand what place are you coming from, because when we can feel the passion coming from every single part of your body, and that's not an aggressive passion, it's a care passion, it's a deep care that no matter what, I'm going to help you be the best individual and the best team I possibly can.
I think you're spot on, Craig, because I think for me, it's the intention. If they can feel that that's the intention, if they can identify that's the intention, then you can almost get away with making certain mistakes. Not that I'm saying that you should use it as an opportunity to do so, but I say to coaches sometimes that if a player understands that you're trying with good intention, as you put it, if you're trying, players and parents in particular, they can excuse, if you like, what might be perceived as a failure to achieve in that moment. Because they know it's coming from a good place, right? So they're more you get the patience, you get the grace of their empathy and their compassion to say, actually, do you know what? We're in this together. Whereas if they feel like this is just a show or it's not genuine, you're always going to fall flat on your face, right? As soon as something goes wrong, you're going to be the one that gets outcasted. And I think whether it's young players, whether it's older players, as long as they know you're coming from a good place, and fundamentally, I think, I'd like to believe, and this might be an idealistic view, but that we all as coaches are there with good intention, but maybe not always fully aware of how much our good intention is actually being demonstrated, if it is at all, and the perception of that. So, you know, just talking about that, you know, and I'm conscious of time as well. In your experiences, have you had those moments where you've had coaches where you haven't felt that they're genuine? They're not, you know, the intention isn't there. And it is much more egotistical rather than, like I said, a place of service that they're coming from.
Yeah, you see that. You see this happen in different spaces as well. You know, you'll see quite often with young sports teams, you'll see a parent who comes in who wants the best for their child to be able to achieve something, and so their intention is sometimes too much around their what the vision they want for their own child. When we see and we talk, you know, when we talk about high performance, a coach who moves up to a high performance role, we see two things normally happen. And a good example of this is in rugby. Ian Foster is the current coach of the All Blacks. Now, he came from a run with Steve Hansen where they went 92%. That was they had a 92% success rate, which is phenomenal in any professional or international sport. And he came over, and what happened in the situation was he surrounded himself with people that were slightly below him in ability. So, and sometimes you'll see that, like, coaches will surround themselves with people so they still sit up above. And it's a bit of an insecurity thing. But then you get those coaches that will surround themselves with people that are better than them, and they're comfortable with that. And they're the ones who are successful. So going back to Ian Foster, in the beginning, he started losing a lot of games. And he was at a point where they were actually going to remove him last year. And then they won a game against South Africa, and all the players went to bat and went and saw the CEO and said, "You're making the wrong move here. We all back this coach. There needs to be some changes." And they all, and I think he knew as well, the coach, but also the body did. They said, "Let's make the changes, and this team's gonna really take off." And they lost a game in the weekend, but they went 11 games unbeaten the season since then. So they're back on track, but they surround themselves with now better coaches than the head coach. Now he's in the right frame of mind. And so as a coach, it's important to surround yourself with people that know more than you. If that's the players, draw that out of them. Let them share when they've got more talent than you, more experience than you. I talked to my dad the other day. My dad is a really successful coach. He got interviewed for the role in that team that went 16 years unbeaten partway through it. And the caveat from the players were, if you get the role, you're the coach, but realize that in this team, there are greater expertise than you've ever had and have greater experiences. So yes, you're coach, but realize that you need to allow us to do certain things because we know how to do it and we've got the expertise. And it was really, really powerful. And I know it took my dad back. My dad's, you know, he's got, he's a very proud man, right? He's a very proud man, come a tough neighborhood. We had to fight for everything. And so, you know, a great lesson. I love talking to dad about that. And, you know, I'm sure at the time it rocked him, but he realized, you know what? I don't need to be the smartest person in the room. You know what? I'm actually probably the least smartest person in the room, but I know how to make this team gel. And I can get them into an environment where they can continue winning. And that doesn't mean that I'm the most important person in the room. I'm actually the least.
But actually, I think there's something really powerful within that, right? Because it also allows you to be in a position where you almost do take a step back and actually start to observe a little bit more around what's going on around you, right? And then you start to pick up, piece things together and draw on an external perception of all these experts, if you like, in the room, and where you can potentially connect the dots. And, you know, as many great leaders do, they're not often the source of the information, but they're the ones connecting the dots, and maybe delegating duties and tasks to each individual within the group or the wider teams, if you like. So I think there's actually so many benefits of that. But I think the biggest piece to kind of really take away from it is that there is a sense of self-awareness and reflection that's gone on to actually where am I positioned in this group? Yes, this is my role, but what can I actually bring to the table? Yes, this person's played, you know, 100 odd games at an international level that I've never done, but actually what experiences can I bring to the table that actually they've not done? And how do we, you know, amalgamate the two things together so that everyone is bringing their own thing? And I'm just thinking out loud, and it just takes me back to one of my first experiences working in a club at an elite level, if you like. And it was one of the first things I saw, there was a bit of conflict between the coaches and the people from different departments. And I thought to myself, why? Everyone's here for a reason, right? And if we're all in different departments and we're all considered experts in different roles and areas of the game or areas of development, so why don't we lean on one another so that we can maximize that? Because there's going to be things that, you know, that I just haven't had the opportunity to learn yet, and vice versa, right? Some of the things that can't necessarily be taught unless you've experienced them, some of them actually you can't learn unless you study them. So why not blend those things together? And actually, if you've got the overall person kind of composing the orchestra in that respect, then, you know, that there should be some magical outcomes if you get the right people in place.
Yeah, and I look, if I look back to my career so far, whether I'm in a CEO role or a facilitating role or a specifically named coaching role, by the way, I'm always coaching. That's my philosophy, and no matter what I'm doing. But it is, you know, those times where I fell into leading role rather than when I should have been following is where I made the biggest mistakes and had the biggest learnings, to be really honest. And you know, I still remember one of those being a 15-year-old kid who I, for whatever reason, I remember what it was. I was chasing too hard to achieve something with the team. I was trying too damn hard. And instead of sitting in a space where I should have been following at that moment, I was trying to lead. And I was trying to lead too much. And it actually created conflict. And that 15-year-old kid gave me one of the best reality checks of my life. You know, I had to eat some real humble pie. And so, you know, we're all going to make mistakes along the way. You know, to me, you only fail if you make the same mistake twice and you're not learning from it. And so we're always going to make mistakes. But and if we do that when we're supposed to be following and rather than being the pure leader at that moment, make sure you damn well learn from it and let your pride go, right? Pride can get in our way so often. And so just consider those moments where, and how can you make everyone else feel like the most interesting people in the room rather than yourself?
100%. Craig, it's been a really insightful conversation. Like, we've gone in so many different directions. I'm sure there's a hell of a lot more that could go into it because I'm starting to think about so many things. But before we jump into that rabbit hole, I just want to say thank you for your time really today and really much appreciate it. And if you've got any final messages that you want to leave the listeners.
Yeah, I think the important thing for me, and I love talking about this, and that is the importance of being relentless in the pursuit of excellence, in the pursuit of developing talent, the pursuit of helping people fulfill their potential. But we need to be relentless without being ruthless or reckless. And so when it comes to be relentless in that drive for seeking something, we need to understand that's not 24/7. So the relentless approach means, and from a high performance, know when to switch off, know when to recover, know when to allow people to step up and be in their roles and you to step back and be the follower or the eagle looking above. But don't go into a space of ruthlessness where you take no prisoners, where the ruthless is you're coming along no matter what the consequences are to the people around you, what the collateral damage may be. Always protect the people around you and including yourself. And then make sure you're not being reckless. You know, always be aware of the consequences and please don't be careless of the consequences. You know, the only time I have potentially that I can actually there is one instance that may be different to this, and I think it's Michael Jordan. I do not think that the Chicago Bulls would have got 6 titles in that dynasty they had if Michael Jordan hadn't been relentless, ruthless, and reckless to win those titles. However, the collateral damage that's occurred after that to certain individuals, I kind of sit back and wonder, was it all worth it? I mean, I love seeing the Chicago Bulls do what they did. They certainly didn't have the most talented, gifted teams that were in the NBA at the time. But they damn well knew how to win because that of that approach that Michael Jordan had and obviously the support of Phil Jackson working together. But that was one of the few times where I think you go beyond just being relentless to achieve something.
Yeah, and I'm conscious I don't want to dump into another rabbit hole here, but I think the one thing I would say on it is, though, is that sometimes not just the price for that success.
Yeah, and look, but my question is, can we do it without there being a cost, a collateral damage to people or someone along the way? Yeah, there might be to the other teams, but you can't control it. You can only control your environment, but the people you look after and protect as a coach, your job is to protect the human first.
I think you're spot on. Again, Massive thank you, Craig. I really appreciate your time today. Don't know if you want to let the listeners know where they can get in touch with you if you want if they had any further questions or any of the work that you do.
Thank you. I'm always on LinkedIn. I share a lot of insights and thoughts on LinkedIn and other social medias, but that's my main one. And also craigjohns.com.au and speakersinstitutecorporate.com. You'll find me at any of those places.
Thank you. Amazing, Craig. Thank you again for your time.
You're welcome. Real pleasure.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.